Hello, and welcome to the November 2007 Learn at Lunch, sponsored by the Faculty and Staff Assistance Program and Vice Chancellor Steve Relier. The topic today is Men and Online Sexual Behavior, Worry, Problem, or Compulsion. Our speaker is Doug Braun Harvey. He is a licensed marriage and family therapist since 1982 and a certified group psychotherapist since 1994. He received his master's degree in counseling from National University and is the clinical director of the Sexual Dependency Institute, which he founded in 1993. SDI provides outpatient therapy to men of all sexual orientations who are concerned about their sexual behavior. Doug Braun Harvey is a qualified expert witness for the San Diego Superior Court on gay male battering syndrome. He is also a lecturing faculty member at San Diego State University in their Masters of Counseling program. He has over 20 years' experience working in all levels of mental health, care, and treatment, and has a private practice providing individual and group therapy in San Diego. It is my pleasure to welcome Doug Braun Harvey.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Learn at Lunch. We're going to do something at lunch today that we don't usually do, and that is we're going to talk about sex in a public forum with other people and other adults. And if you think about it, we don't do this very often. We don't talk with other adults in a safe, respectful, and informed way about sexual behavior. And that's often, I like to say that when I first start my talks, because it is a rare experience to sit with other adults and talk about a concern about sexual behavior with somebody who's informed, who you might have some information that you'd like to learn. So that's what we're going to do for about the next 90 minutes. And we're going to talk about a particular aspect of sexual behavior. And we're going to talk about the advent of access to sexual imagery, content, information that's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on every continent on the planet, completely nonstop. And only in the last 15 or possibly 20 years has mankind ever had to deal with such a resource of sexual information available at all times in all places, in the privacy of your own home, in the privacy of a secluded room where no one knows you're accessing this information. And you can talk to anybody around the world about who you are sexually and who they are sexually. And so this is a very new experience for us. And we're going to talk a little bit about people who have some worries about relating to this technology, maybe have some problems, and some people who, for whatever reason, really describe their relationship with online sexual information and behavior as really out of control. And so we're going to talk about just sort of what does that look like? How do we know when that may be the concern? So we're going to talk a little bit about, when I give a talk, I always like to talk about sexual health. Often we talk about sexual problems, what are the concerns about sexuality, what people think about are sexual problems. Rarely do we have an opportunity to think about, well, what does sexual health look like? What is sexuality when things are looking okay and it's actually a healthy part of one's life? So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And then we're also going to talk about what are some of the motivations for people to use online access for sexual activity. As well as distinguish this issue between what's just a general worry when things become more of a problem and when things really become out of control, and how to think about those distinctions. And then we're going to look a little bit about what those signs of out-of-control sexual behavior are. So there's a little more information about that particular aspect that tends to be what people are most concerned about is when online sexual behavior is out of control. So those are our objectives. But before we get to our objectives, and the people watching are going to have to sit quietly for about a few minutes, because I'm going to ask the people that are here to fill out the form that's in front of you. You were given a form that is a sexual health inventory. This is an opportunity, if you have a moment with yourself, to think about your own attitudes and values about sexual health. No one's going to see this. No one's going to read it. It's a private moment to have with yourself. And I'd just like you to go through and read each item and just rate how much you either agree or disagree with each item that's on the sheet. And it's just a moment to spend with your own feelings and attitudes about sexual health. Right. If you're watching at home, you're on the right place. We are talking about online sexual behavior. The people here attending are filling out a inventory that takes about 3 to 4 or 5 minutes to fill out. That's an opportunity for them to think for themselves about certain attitudes about sexual health. I'll tell you at home what some of the items they're rating themselves on. They either agree, strongly disagree, neither agree, disagree, agree, or strongly agree. And I'll tell you about the item that's the most important on the entire inventory. The most important item on this inventory is I talk about my sexuality with my doctor as it relates to my health care. We know through sex research and sexual health research that the number one correlate of people having sexual health is that they feel they can go to their doctor and talk openly about any concerns they have about their sexual behavior or their sexual life, that they have a medical or some healthcare provider that they can talk to openly about their concerns. When people say they do not have that in their lives, that's a very significant sexual health risk factor. So if you answered the question, I talk about my sexuality with my doctor as it relates to my healthcare, and you strongly agree with that, you've got a good measure of sexual health in your life already that you can talk with your doctor. There's many other items on there, and we're not going to be able to go through that. The people here will be able to have an experience of that. Okay, we're not going to talk about it. It's just a moment to sort of think and reflect and get here and think about, we're going to talk about sexuality, and that list was a variety of things about human sexual behavior. I want to show you a cartoon strip from Doonesbury. This appeared several years ago, and when it appeared in the Sunday Comics, there were 50 or more newspapers around the country that refused to publish this particular comic strip. Now, what's interesting about this comic strip, it actually uses an actual piece of research that had come out recently that was a sexual health-based piece of information. And you'll see how he uses that research to show how people react to conversations about sex. So we'll just watch the cartoon together. The reason I like to show this comic is that even when we have really good information about sexual health, people are uncomfortable talking about it. If there was a new piece of information that had to deal with cancer prevention, or had to deal with heart disease, or had to deal with a certain virus or bacteria out there that was really important information for the public health, it would be a very welcomed conversation to pass on that information. But when it comes to sexual health information, people are very uncomfortable. Where do we talk about sexual health information? In what situations? With whom do we talk about such information? There's a lot of different attitudes about talking about sexual health information. And even in the family home, there's different feelings about what we should do and not do when it comes to talking about sexual health. So what is sexual health? Our former Surgeon General, David Satcher, who was the Surgeon General at the end of the Clinton administration and the beginning of the first administration of our current president, was the first Surgeon General to actually release a Surgeon General's report on sexual health in America. And it was somewhat controversial. There was questions about whether this report would actually be released, but it finally was. And David Satcher was the first Surgeon General of the United States to say, we need to look at the status of the sexual health in our country. After he left office, he created a what's called the National Consensus Process on Sexual Health, and he brought together 200 and some experts who are leaders in the field of understanding sexuality and want to have clear messages about sexual health in our country, and brought them together in what he called the Consensus Symposium, and he was very interested in seeing could we get all of these leaders, these very influential people, to agree on certain definitions, certain kind of principles around sexual health. And this gathering was able to agree on this definition of sexual health. So, and it was a consensus, so everybody had to agree to this. There could be no disagreement. And so they came up with that sexual health is a state of physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, and social well-being. So there's a lot there with sexual health. It's not just a physical, body-related issue. There's a lot of things that go on with sexual health. And it's not just related to one's sexuality, how one feels, how one experiences who they are sexually, but also their sexual behavior. What do you do sexually? Sometimes we feel something sexually, it doesn't mean we do it, and other times we have sexual behaviors that either are consistent or not consistent with our values or attitudes. And that when somebody is sexually healthy, they integrate that sexuality into their lives. It's not a separate, completely compartmentalized, separate thing. It's part and integrated into somebody's life. And another thing about sexual health that's very important is that in order to have sexual health, you have to avoid or reduce harmful consequences related to sexuality, because sexuality can have harmful consequences if it's not pursued in ways that are respectful of oneself or others. And we're here to talk about a little bit about what is sexual health online. Because the internet and online is now a part of human sexual behavior, so what does sexual health look like online, and when is it a worry or a problem or a concern? The World Health Organization came up with a model for sexual health. Now, they did an interesting thing. They had to come up with what does it look like when people are in refugee camps around the world, where hundreds of thousands, if not a million people, are living together in another country, in tents, in these cities that literally appear overnight because of political unrest or instability in a country. And, of course, people are going to be sexual in these situations. What do we tell them who are cross-culture, cross-language, cross-nationality? What are some basic messages we could give somebody in a highly stressed situation that if you're going to be sexual, these are kind of the basic ground rules for sexual health? And this is what the World Health Organization came up with. That first of all, anybody you're going to be sexual with, hopefully you have shared values. That why you're having sex with this person is a similar value as to why this person's having sex with you. So you don't want to be having sex where the meaning of the sex for the other person is a very different value than it does for you. So the more shared the value is, the more sexually healthy the sexual activity is. This is a very important one, that the sex is consensual. That anybody involved in the sexual activity is agreeing to that activity and is of an age to make that decision. That it's not exploitive, that you're not using power imbalances to gain access to sex. Somebody needs food, somebody needs shelter, somebody is scared of their own physical well-being, and they may exploit that situation to have access to sex in order to provide what the person needs. That's a way of exploiting somebody for sexual contact, and we don't want to be exploiting people in that way. That it's honest, This is going to be a very important aspect of what we're going to talk about today with online sexual behavior. The honesty, the openness. How much is this even talked about in people's homes or families that online sexual behavior is happening? This was the most controversial one the World Health Organization came up with, that the sexual activity should be mutually pleasurable. Now, we may think, well, of course, in our country here, but the reality is in most of the planet, most of the people who live on the planet, the idea that sexual interaction should be mutually pleasurable is not an agreed upon value. That you, in most places in the planet, usually the male sexual activity is the focus, and the female sexual pleasure is either not considered or of no value, or even seen as something that's not a moral kind of aspiration for a woman to even seek. So that was a very controversial position for the World Health Organization to say, is that everybody's sexual pleasure is important. And of course, sexuality should be protected against sexually transmitted diseases and pregnancy if pregnancy is not a desired outcome. So that's what the World Health Organization came up with. Eli Coleman, who's the director of the Program in Human Sexuality at the University of Minnesota. Those of you who are at UCSD will understand the importance of what I'm going to say. But the University of Minnesota is the only place in the world that has an endowed chair in sexual health. At universities, they have things that are endowed chairs, and it means that topic is going to be a part of the university's curriculum and education forever and ever and ever. They always hire people to teach that subject matter. There is no endowed chair anywhere at any university in the country except the University of Minnesota. So Eli Coleman is the first head of the chair of the endowed chair at the University of Minnesota in the Program in Human Sexuality. So this is very, very far-reaching in the sense that the University of Minnesota guarantees there's going to be one academic institution in our country that's committed to studying, understanding, and researching sexual health in our country. And Eli came up with 9 different ways that we can promote sexual health, and one of them is here today. We're doing some comprehensive sex education. This is a sexual health activity we're doing today. Those of you at home watching on the video or listening, this is a sexual health activity in your life to be sitting here and listening to this lecture or watching. You're getting some sex education. Some of you might be health professionals who are here or watching as well, and this is a health professional sex education activity, very important for sexual health. Child and adolescent sexuality research. We have a significant problem. We know very little about child and adolescent sexuality. How do we research 9-year-olds' ideas about what sexual intercourse is? How do we research at what age span children begin a first idea of understanding intercourse to really understanding conception, to really understanding the birth process, and having developmental milestones that we understand that children go through? We don't know any of this because it's so difficult to research. It's so controversial to try to understand a child or adolescent sexual world because people have so many different feelings about even talking about sexuality with adolescents and children, no less what would be a reasonable way to gather information about what their world is like. This is an area we know very, 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 very little about. Overcoming homophobia, biphobia, or transphobia. In other words, if we're going to have a more sexual health environment, we have to understand that not everybody who's sexual is heterosexual. And we live in a world that sort of tends to think that unless you're heterosexual, there's something less of quality about your sexuality, less of value about your sexuality, or in some ways maybe even not as an ethical or as a moral form of sexuality. And so from a sexual health perspective, we really want to overcome these attitudes to realize that there's such a diversity of sexuality. That we limit our ability to be sexually healthy if we determine everybody is supposed to be one way. Sexual violence, of course, is an enormous problem in the world. Promoting masturbation. Those of you who can remember our Surgeon General, the first Surgeon General, Joycelyn Elders, under the Clinton administration, she promoted masturbation education as a possible sexual health intervention for adolescents. And because she promoted this, she lost her job. She was fired for even using the word masturbation in conjunction with adolescence. So we have a lot of concerns about what to do about this issue of masturbation and how we relate to it. This is a very, very significant issue, masturbation, when it comes to online sexual behavior. We're going to talk a lot about sexual health related to the issue of masturbation in someone's life. promoting sexual functioning. Obviously, well, the most common thing we think about with sexual health is sexual functioning. You know, do I feel aroused? Can I have an orgasm? Will my body respond the way I want it to? Does it feel good? Do I want it? Am I happy? These are the kinds of things that people mostly think about when they think of sexual health. Access to health care. We know that there's an enormous problem with access to medical and other kinds of physical health needs. To see somebody who's been trained enough in understanding sexual issues, that people can get good diagnosis around disorders related to sexual health. Because a lot of our medical care practitioners aren't well educated in this area. A lot of doctors don't have a lot of good training when it comes to sexuality and sexual health. It's one of the areas in the program in human sexuality that the University of Minnesota is very committed to. Every physician who graduates from the University of Minnesota has a very extensive training in human sexuality and sexual health to become a physician through the University of Minnesota. Wouldn't it be interesting if all of our medical schools were so invested in that kind of training? And most importantly, sexual health really is a basic human right. We certainly would think it's a basic human right to eat, to breathe, good air. Sexuality is so basic to human life and the continuation of human life that sexual health is really an essential part of basically being human. So there's things that get in the way of sexual health that the consensus symposium talked about. We're going to talk about how some of these issues come into play with online behavior. Some of the things that get in the way or enhance sexual health, certainly the family. We saw in our cartoon, the comic strip, that the family can be an impediment to sexual health. All somebody has to say is, we don't talk about that here. And whatever that information is, it stops. And so the family can either be a place where sexual health is enhanced or sexual health is detracted from. There's a new program on HBO this season called Tell Me You Love Me. And it's a very, very sexually graphic image, stories of people's marriage lives and relationship lives showing their sex lives. There's a lot of detail about sexuality that's in this program. And they do it in a very respectful and well-informed way. And a scene I'm remembering now as I'm talking to you is there was a scene of a 12-year-old daughter who's started her cycle and has had her menstruation for a period of time, and the hormones are going through her body. And they show her watching a kind of a sexy scene between a man and a woman kissing in a pool. And you can tell by the way it's filmed that she's kind of feeling these first stirrings in her body of arousal. She's now has sufficient hormones in her body that she's experiencing her body in a way she never has before. And she calls it the tingle. I don't know what to do with this tingle. And there's this wonderful scene where she talks with her mother about beginning to masturbate. She doesn't call it that. She has a kind of a euphemism for sort of touching herself and is very embarrassed by this, but wants to talk to her mother about it. And it's a marvelous scene between a mother and a daughter just trying to talk about the fact that her daughter is engaged in this kind of behavior. And the mother's response. There's very few places in homes where I think children and parents have this kind of conversation and the daughter was very relieved to have had this conversation with her mother. So I think it was a 3-minute scene in the show, but it showed how important the family can be to either an impediment or actually a support for sexual health. Certainly values. There's all sorts of values about sexuality. We're not going to get into those today, but you know how certain values can either encourage discussion of sexuality or certain values can really make sexuality a frightening and anxiety-producing discussion to have. The media is a very important issue. That's why we're here to talk about. The internet is the media. We think of the media as like broadcast networks, but actually the internet is the largest media and the most influential media we have on the planet right now. And so the media messages are very important. This is a media message. They can be very influential for helping with sexual health or not. Religion and spiritual beliefs. This is one of the most important factors of all with sexual health. When we research about sexual health and sexual attitudes, one's religion and most importantly, church attendance is most related to sexual health values. Whatever church you attend, whatever the spectrum of all the different churches and religious beliefs there are in the world, when you are a church attender, whatever the values are of sexuality in that church most likely will be the same behavior and values of the person who attends the church. If you have the same attitudes of a church, but you don't attend, your sexual behavior is far less related to the values of your church. It's church attendance that's related with highly influencing sexual health and sexual values. So that's just an important thing to understand. When you go to church a lot, your religious environment will have an enormous influence on your attitudes and values about sexuality. And that's regardless of whatever your religion is. We know that there are certain physical and mental conditions that get in the way of sexual health, peer pressure, and a variety of other things. But here's an example of sexual health. In other words, if we're going to have sexual health, we have to tell people what our sexual health status is, right? We have to be able to say, this is where my body's at, where's yours? Sort of funny to look at, but nonetheless, this is an example of how difficult it is to talk about even the most basic aspects of sexual health is when we have an infection that might affect someone who affects us. People may ask, why is this talk about men's online sexual behavior rather than women or men and women together? And the reason I specifically chose men's online sexual behavior is that with the preliminary research we have, and it's fairly still rudimentary because this is a medium that it's so difficult to research because it's so pervasive and it's so new. But one of the understandings we have so far is that actually when you get online, the gender of the person who's online, whether it's a man and a woman, is a phenomenally influential determiner of what happens online, particularly when it comes to sexual activity or any kind of sexual behavior online. Men and women just do very, very different things online when it comes to sexual behavior. For men, men tend to focus far more on the image that's in front of them. Men want to see visual imagery. They're very interested in visually what's happening. And for them, it's a visual and auditory experience. Women will relate, they're far more focused on the relating aspect of being online. Chat rooms, talking live chat. Women are much more interested in the relational experience of who they're talking to online. Men are far more high-frequency users of the visual information that's available online for sexual, either sexual information or sexual arousal. And this tends to be true in other countries as well. I'm going to just give a little bit of information about a recent survey that came out. This is not published data yet. It'll be published soon this year, but the author decided to let me just give some preliminary information. Because I'm on a campus, this is also a workplace, I thought it'd be interesting to give a little of information about online sexual behavior in the workplace, which for many people is a significant sign of sexual behavior being a problem or out of control. That they are using their internet access that they have through their employer to have access to sexual imagery, sexual content, or communicating with another person about sexuality in a way that the workplace isn't designed for. And so this survey was done in 2004. Over 15,000 people were surveyed. And Julie Albright from USC did this study. What she found in analyzing this data was that 21% of the people of that 15,000, of the men of that 15,000, said that they actually accessed sexual content at work. So that's about one out of every five men in the workplace are accessing sexual content from their computer at work. Now, this is usually a company-owned computer, by the way. This is not their laptop they're bringing into their own office. This is the machine that they've been given in their workplace. Now, women, it's 17%, so it's less. We also know this is true between men and women, is that women use the internet less frequently and less often for online sexual activity than men. Women are just lower users of the internet for those purposes. They asked about emailing coworkers. 15% of the men said that they admitted emailing a sexual image to a coworker, not just a sexual talk or sentence or something provocative. They actually emailed a sexual image to a coworker, 15%. men in the workplace, where 8% of the women said that they had engaged in that kind of behavior. They asked about being caught at work, having your online sexual behavior discovered at work. And 7% of the men said that their online sexual activity was discovered. They were caught on some sort of online sexual activity. 5% of the women disclosed getting caught. Now, what that means, if we go back to those percentages, which I'm not going to go back to, what that really means is about two-thirds of all the men and women in the workplace who are going online and making accessing sexual sites never have that behavior discovered. So there's a much higher percentage who are actually engaging the activity that we have no idea what they're doing. So before we get into online activity, let's just talk a little bit about this issue of online sexual activity. What is it? Why do people do this? I mean, if there's risks at the workplace, there's so many other places to gain access to sexual information other than your computer on the workplace, you know, why do people sometimes just use very poor judgment about where and how they're using online sexual information or activity? So one of the central questions that's sort of being asked, and this is true with any time there's a new sexual activity or technology, the question is this going to change the way people have sex? Now, I did an article on this issue around online sexual activity and found out that every new technology that's been invented since the still camera in the middle of the 1800s, every new technology that has had a sexual application that could be applied to sexual behavior, that technology took off really rapidly. And the reason the technology succeeded and became economically viable in the country for the general consumer was because the people who bought the technology first bought it for its sexual application. For example, cameras were too expensive when photography was first invented, but they figured out they could take pictures of nude people for sexual arousal. And that was how the camera makers first made money making cameras, because people bought cameras so they could take pictures of nude people, because lots of people wanted to have pictures of nude people. Nobody had ever seen a picture of a nude person before in the world. Imagine that. The only nude people they ever saw were paintings or a live person. Imagine how that changed the world. I can see a nude body through a photograph. So when it has a sexual application, we can wrap fast forward to VHS and beta. Those of you who remember when videotape came out. Is it going to be beta or VHS? Well, the reason VHS eventually won out over beta was that VHS was willing to have their technology utilized for the sex video industry, and beta was not. And so that technology took off because people were willing to buy sex videos and wanted them, and they were only available in VHS. So they had to go buy a VHS player, not a beta player. So we've been going through, you know, learning about how our sexual life is affected by technology for centuries. This is our newest one. So the internet is just a new technology to apply to sexuality. It's not like we've ever had to figure out what to do with technology and sex before. We've been doing this a long time. One question is sex under the internet could actually be a way for really seeing and discussing sexuality out loud. I think that's one of the things the internet really provides, and a lot of people are interested in this. You can go on the internet and you get to talk to people about sex. You get to discuss about sex. You get to hear people discuss their sexual lives in ways that hardly ever happens in real-time interactions with other people. It's a phenomenally valuable experience for many, many people. However, when you look at the internet, oftentimes what's going on the internet really just kind of mirrors what people are doing in real life as well. There's not a whole lot of different things that go on the internet that people aren't doing in real life as well. I'll talk about what the differences are with internet sex in a minute, but I think it's just real important to notice that when you really look at what's happening online, all that's happening is that people have much more access to information they never had before. But what human beings do sexually hasn't changed all that much over time. So why do people do it? What's so interesting about being online? What's the value of that? Some people might look at it and think, well, how dull, how ridiculous. Why would you sit at a computer terminal, you know, involved in kind of sexual activity? Well, there's some really practical reasons why online sexual activity is so interesting to people. First of all, it's affordable. Now, I'm dating myself a bit here, but when I was growing up and you wanted to have access to any kind of sexual imagery, you had to pay for it, and it was expensive. You had to go to a movie theater. You had to go to a bookstore. It was very difficult to find things through the mail. It wasn't that long ago in our country that if you mailed sexual content through the mail, it was a federal crime. So there was a lot of restrictions on access to sexual information. And it was therefore because the access was so restricted, you could charge a lot of money for it because it was not easy to come by. So, you know, economic class became a huge issue here, and that was access to sexual information and sexual imagery was really something that was based on economic class. So the internet levels the playing field a bit here. It's much more affordable for many more people. This is one of the keys of the internet. It's anonymous. Well, not completely. People think if they go online, it's really anonymous. It's more anonymous than walking down the sidewalk, paying a ticket to go into an adult movie theater, and walking in and wondering who you're going to see in that movie theater, or going to a strip club, or walking into an adult bookstore, or going to a sex shop to buy condoms, or something like that. The internet provides a lot more anonymity for those kinds of sexual activities and behaviors that somebody might be involved in. It's very convenient. I mean, how convenient can it get? You can be in your slippers and your robe, and you can kind of have access to all sorts of sexual stuff. You don't even have to get dressed. Very convenient. The internet and online sexual activity, this is where we're going to talk a little bit about problems and when it gets out of control, is that going online for sexual activity is a very powerful escape. You can kind of immerse yourself into this world of sexual content and sexual world. Those of you who've been on the internet for all sorts of reasons know you can be looking up recipes and all of a sudden it's an hour later and it's like, my God, where did the time go? You know, the internet is a little bit of a, distorts our sense of time, just a little bit. It's different than television because television has commercials, television programs start and end, and we don't get quite as disoriented in watching television as we do on the internet. We can really get immersed in it. It's a form of electronic intimacy. People will say and do things, reveal things, disclose things, talk about things with people online that they wouldn't talk about even with their own spouse, with people they love and care about, or even their therapist or their priest or minister or rabbi. You can find people online who are interested in the same things about sex that you are interested in. And there are some people in the population who are interested in things sexually that make them very stigmatized, may make them feel very ashamed or very worried about themselves, might feel very chagrined if anybody knew that that was something sexually they were interested in. And you can go online and talk about those things, find people who might be interested in those sorts of things sexually, and you don't run into the stigma like you would if you were to try to talk about that in public. People experiment a lot online. Online sexual activity is a place where you can say, gee, I'm going to check that out. I'm going to see what that's like. People will even, you know, create a false identity. They'll change their gender. They'll turn into a man online rather than a woman and go out and present themselves as a man just to kind of see what that world looks like. You can experiment in so many ways. You can be older rather than younger. You can be younger rather than older. You can change so much about yourself just to experiment with different identities online. And some people find that quite interesting. There's a lot of fantasies you can actually experience online that can have less of a risk. I can share a fantasy with you. You can share your fantasy with me. It's a little bit like maybe when phone sex was a big deal in the late 70s and 80s. Phone sex lines were a really big thing where people would talk about sex and maybe share fantasies. Online, there's much more ready access to people who might have similar fantasies to you. We don't think about it as often, but online, it removes two factors of sexuality that for some people are real barriers to sexual activity. One is, it removes the issue of reproduction and pregnancy and STDs. You can be sexually active and not be worried about any of those consequences with sexual activity, unless you actually meet up with somebody as a result of online connection. But if it's completely done cyberly and there's no direct contact, you can do all sorts of things sexually without worrying about reproduction or sexually transmitted infections. Secondly, some people, the biggest barrier they have to sexuality is who they are socially, interpersonally. They may have very poor social skills, or may have certain things that really interfere with interacting meaningfully with people. Or they may have some really awkward ways of relating. And the time delay of being online lets them be more thoughtful about what they're thinking. They may not say something quite so glib and offensive in the moment. They might be doing email and can really compose a thought and spend some time on what they're going to say, much more differently than they're in a dating situation and they have to think on their feet right now and I have to be charming and wonderful every time, you know, he's done saying something to me. So that's something that people find quite appealing about the online world. This is the one we're also going to talk a lot about with problems and worries and out of control, is the access. It is so accessible. It is just so accessible. There's endless possibilities of partners on the internet. People from all over the world are on the internet. There's just an endless possibility of meeting another person to talk to who may be interested in some form of sexual talk, sexual activity, whatever. There's a lot fewer social cues to have to worry about. People will talk to me about being online, and they don't have to worry about her facial expression. And, you know, did she look at me like kind of weird? Did she think that was kind of disgusting that I said that? Or, you know, did she not like that? Many people, those kinds of interpersonal social moments really interfere with sexual functioning, arousal. They worry a lot. And so online, with those fewer social cues, some people will experience their sexual desires, sexual arousals more readily because they don't have those social cues to have to interfere. This is why this is so, the internet and online sexual activity is so desirable for adolescents or college-age people, because they get to experience all sorts of aspects of who they are sexually without having to have all the awkwardness of those social encounters that can be such a detriment initially in learning how to interact. Now, there's positives and negatives to that, but that is something that some people like sometimes about the online world. I mentioned how they can think and construct their ideas more constructively. Many people are now using online sexual activity as an entrance into physical intimacy before emotional intimacy. That somebody will get together sexually, have a sexual encounter with somebody, and use that as information as to whether they'd be interested in emotionally getting to know this person. That's a very different way of connecting for people. But some people are actually using the internet for that way of figuring out and sorting who they may want to be with. They may want to be with the person sexually before they even think about whether they'd want to be with the person emotionally. Now, people may have all sorts of value judgments about that and reactions to that, but for some people, that seems to be something that motivates them to be online. You can certainly explore any kind of sexual interest or desire that would be highly stigmatized. I already talked about that. But the internet is really a far less stigmatized area to explore sexuality than most other places. You can share something verbally. And we know through research that if somebody shares something in text, through written words, rather than saying it, they tend to experience, if they're taking a high risk, like sharing an unusual turn-on or something that they think would really be highly stigmatized, if they type it, they feel it's less of a risk than if they say it. And so just the media itself, the fact that often in the online you're dealing with text as a way of communicating, even though it's a personally risky piece of information to share, because it's being textually written, the person feels less frightened about saying it. And so the online world is a place where people who are maybe discovering there's something very unusual that turns them on, and they can't believe that's their turn on and they feel ashamed of it or whatever, may for the first time in their life actually type it rather than they would ever say it to somebody. And it's much easier to, this is another part of where we're going to get into problems and worries, when you're texting somebody or you're typing something, the repercussions of that communication are far less immediately felt than if you say that to somebody. If you're looking at somebody in the eye and you say something to them and it has a negative consequence, you deal with it because of their facial expression, their feeling state, their eyes, their body language. You deal with so much more immediate intimate consequences for that interaction. Online, you can type something on a text. All of that information's not there. And you don't have to deal with that part of relating. There's positives and there's a lot of negatives to that. This is, I think, the central question I see in couples who are trying to understand online sexual behavior. We now have this reality of online sex, internet sex is available. So now we have an entire population in our country, married, dating, single, adolescents growing up, any aspect of where you're at regarding your sexuality and your sexual status. We have to figure out, is online sexual activity real sex? In other words, people have agreements in their marriages. You're sexual with me, I'm sexual with you, that's it. We're only sexual with each other. Well, where does online sexual activity violate that agreement? Cross that boundary of monogamy, fidelity, sexual exclusivity? Where does any kind of online sexual activity violate that agreement? And the biggest dilemma I see is nobody's talking about this. The only time this issue gets talked about is if when somebody makes a mistake and crosses the agreement. And the agreement's never been said out loud. It's only when there's a violation that's like, no, 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 you ain't supposed to be doing that. Yet it's never been talked about. So we're going to talk a lot about how this is an enormous issue and it will always be an issue in all of our relationships in this country from now on. What is your agreement? What have you talked about relating online sexual activity as it relates to your marriage or your situation at home? I'll give you an example. I worked with a man who was a grandfather, and he was doing some online sexual activity. He didn't know his grandchildren were home. One of them opens the door. He wasn't masturbating, but he had a sexual image on screen, and his grandchild walks in the room, and he felt terrible, just awful. But, how does he tell his wife, honey, if the grandkids come over, don't let them come in the room because I'm looking at sex images. Right? I mean, so how do homes deal with this? How do you deal with this? So there's boundaries, there's respect, but there's also not something that's never talked about, so you can't make it safe for people in homes. So this is a reality that's going to not go away. It's not going to go away. Some people wonder, when I'm online on the internet, is what I'm doing sexually part of me or not? Is that who I am sexually, or is that just sort of like this kind of, like, you know how something will go on vacation and do something really strange in some other country, and it's not really us, and we just do it and have fun, and then we come home and it's like, well, I would never do that living here, but I did it there. Some people relate to the internet that way. Well, I only do that online. That's not me. It's like a little vacation from me, right? And so the internet, sometimes for some people sexually, is this sense of, well, that's not who I am sexually. That's like this other part of me I just kind of go to every now and then, but it's not me. Must I actually do sexual activity in order for it to be online sexual activity? So in other words, what if I'm looking at images but not masturbating? Or what if I'm looking at images and masturbating but I never connect up and have sex with another person? What if I only go online to look at sex ads to hire somebody for sex, but I never hire them? I just get off on looking at the ads. Is that, what if I call them and try to have sex talk with a sex worker? I never hire them. I like to talk to sex workers. It's part of my fantasy. Is that a violation? You can go every step of the spectrum. When does it actually become sexual behavior? Other than actually, genital contact or some sort of physical contact that's about sexuality. Is that the only thing that counts? In the online world, couples are struggling with this all the time. And they don't know how to talk about it. Must I be with some in real time in order for it to be online sexual activity? In other words, what if the person I'm typing with, they're typing with on the other end, and we're masturbating, and we both masturbate while we're typing to each other? Is that like having sex with somebody or not? I never have another, I don't have any human contact other than I touch a keyboard and look at words and masturbate? Is that sexual activity outside of the relationship? Couples are really struggling with these questions. The source of most online worries in a relationship are either that someone is having a fantasy or an arousal about somebody other than their primary partner. This is an enormous concern with online sexual behavior. Who is it? What's the image? Who are you talking to? What is it that's happening online that isn't about me, your partner, the person you love, the person you care about? What is that about? And these are important conversations for couples to have, because oftentimes the partner can't talk about it. They don't really understand what their motivation is for being online. And the person themselves, who's maybe concerned or worried about their partner's online behavior, doesn't really quite know what to think about the fact that their partner's doing this. So these are difficult conversations. The biggest issue with online sexual behavior is having the couple figure out, when is the online sexual behavior a boundary crossing between us as a couple? When does that happen? And most times these boundary crossings have something to do with masturbation. I think one of the things that online sexual behavior is bringing out into the open is the fact that adults in marital or committed relationships masturbate. And that's not about the relationship having a problem. It's what adults have done forever. And this is how people learn about their bodies. It's how people understand who they are. It's access to masturbations and access to sexual expression when your partner's not home or on the road or unavailable. Or there's all sorts of reasons for masturbation. And one of the resources for masturbation that some people are finding is being online, is a way of increasing arousal or stimulation for masturbation. And couples don't know what to do about this. They don't know how to think about it. The one thing about sex, unless you're very specific, people don't know what you're talking about. In the online world, the benefit of the online world is you have to be very specific. Metaphors and vagary doesn't work as effectively online as when we talk about sex in person. When we talk about sex in person, we use metaphors. You know, make love, right? That's a metaphor. Make love could mean all sorts of things to all sorts of different people. You're not really saying what's happening. The President of the United States was asked in a court of law, President Clinton was asked in a court of law under subpoena, did you have sex with that woman? They weren't very specific, were they? They didn't say, did she have oral sex with you? They just said, did you have sex? So we resort to these sort of general kind of comments to talk about sex. And we think when we've spoken in a metaphor or a general way, we're actually talking about sex. Online, those kinds of comments don't really carry much weight. You have to be very specific and detailed online. So people online are a much more specific, sexually specific culture. They really say what they want or describe exactly what they mean, because it's the written word. So, if you had to answer this question, based on our talk so far, what do you think, now we're going to talk about men, what do you think is the most common motivation for men to go online? Stress reduction? Imagery? Accessibility? Well, here's my answer to the question. If you can't read it at home, what this says is masturbation doesn't mess with your eyes, really. The primary reason men go online is to enhance their masturbatory life. It's the number one motivator of all. And like a lot of things with sexual health, we don't have some really good ideas about what sexual health and masturbation look like. This is what the internet is requiring us to begin to finally have conversations about. What does an adult male's masturbatory life look like when it's a sexually healthy masturbatory life? And what if that includes online imagery or online activity? Some people might say there's no possibility of having any healthy masturbatory life if it involves online activity. Some people might think that way. But we haven't really had a discussion about this to know. So let's talk now about when online behavior might be more than just all the things I just talked about. When, for whatever reason, it starts to become the first concern I'm going to talk about is that it might become a worry. Now, sexual worries are the kinds of things we all have about sex. I don't know if there's a single sexually active person. Even little kids have sexual worries. Little kids worrying about what their body's going to look like when it matures. Am I going to be attractive? Are boys and girls going to want me? You know, am I going to get married? I mean, these are sexual worries even little kids have. And then you go into adolescence around puberty and development and worries about their body and attractiveness and, oh my gosh, all sorts of things about sex that adolescents are worried about. And then college-age people or high school, people worry about their first sexual experience. Will it be enjoyable? Will I like it? When am I going to have my first sexual experience? I worry if I'm going to have my sexual experience, my first sexual experience before I'm supposed to or before it would be approved of or when it has to be a secret or will I be in love? And these are just sexual worries. Everybody has sexual worries. You can't be sexually active without them. But some of the things that happen with sexual worries is they are something that happens to people of all ages. So it's completely normal to have sexual worries. What I see with online sexual activity is that if people begin to talk about any worries they have about online sexual activity, it immediately gets perceived it must be a problem. We don't have a good history in our culture. How could we? It's only been around a short time. What is a discussion about any kind of worry about one's online sexual activity look like? What does that reasonable conversation look like in a couple or between adults or between a parent and a child? These are such new conversations to have, and it's about sex, that these are very difficult things to do. But sexual worries just tend to generally detract from the pleasure and joy of either living or of sexual activity itself. But they're so normal. When you get into problems, usually when we think about sexual problems, we're talking about groups of people, subgroups of the general population, who are going to be more prone to have certain kinds of problems with sexual activity that are elevated beyond a worry. And it isn't a full-fledged, the last category is a disease or disorder. So it's somewhere in between. So we have things like there are certain sexual problems that affect certain subgroups of people. There are sexual problems that only affect women. There are sexual problems that only affect men. There are only sexual problems that affect heterosexual people. There are only sexual problems that affect lesbians or gay men or transsexual or transgendered people. Certain people in certain subgroups they're going to have certain problems within that population that are unique to them. One of the most common online issues that come up with sexual problems is that somebody has an unusual or extreme sexual turn-on that they are discovering by being online. Somebody's a voyeur and they realize that the only way they really enjoy full sexual pleasure is by watching somebody else have sex. So they go online and discover this, and it's completely legal what they're doing. They're not committing any laws. They're not watching people underage have sex. It's all adults. But that's something they really like to do, and it gives them sexual pleasure. They discover this. And then when they don't have that imagery available to them, they're not having porn in the background while they're having sex with their partner. They can't voyeur that. They may replay the voyeuristic scene in their head while they're having sex in order to fully sexually function with their partner. This is what, when you have an unusual turn-on, this is usually what people do. They visit the unusual turn-on in masturbation, And then they relive it in their brain while they're having sex, because it's the only way they can get completely aroused. Now imagine living with something like that. For many people, that's a significant problem. They don't tell their partners this is how it works for them. They don't disclose that this is their turn-on. It can be an enormous secret between the partners and an enormous source of stress and tension in a relationship. Because, of course, what people want is you're being aroused because you're with me. You know, we're together. You're present. It's what's happening here that's giving you so much pleasure, not what's in your head and it's somewhere else and I'm not even there. You know, that's not what people want to experience in their sexual encounters. But for some people with unusual turn-ons, that's kind of how they function sexually. This can be an enormous problem in a relationship. And this is often what sometimes gets found out when people come and are concerned about a sexual online problem. The most important thing about sexual problems is we know hardly anything about them. What gets researched, what gets studied, what people are, you know, really want to know more about are sexual disorders, you know, erectile dysfunction, low sexual desire, orgasmic difficulties, being pre-orgasmic or having rapid ejaculation and not being able to control your ejaculatory response. These are real diagnosable disorders that people want to get treatment for, and we've put a lot of, you know, emphasis and researching to better understand. But sexual problems are the things we know the least about of all. Examples of sexual problems we know least about. Having affairs, multiple affairs. People might be involved in, out of control sexual behavior. They just can't control their sexual impulses. Things where just it's not a disorder. It's not a complete clinical condition. But it's more than a worry. It's not just the usual general worry in the population people have. So sexual problems, the dilemma with them is that they're the things we know the least about, and actually cause people a lot of distress. So when something's an actual disorder, there are actual sexual disorders that are diagnosed in medical. You know, there are medical diagnoses, there are psychological and psychiatric diagnoses, but, you know, people have low sexual desire, people have, orgasmic difficulty, erectile difficulty, pelvic pain. There's a whole spectrum of pelvic pain disorders that women experience. And, of course, then there's just all other kinds of diagnoses. You know, somebody could have a sexually transmitted infection, some people may have a problems with their reproductive system and unable to conceive. There's all sorts of issues that go with sexuality that are real diagnosable conditions. They're usually studied. They're usually in a very high prevalence. In a study in 1994, 35% of people between the 18 and 59 in this survey reported that they had a sexual problem in the last 12 months. That's over a third of the population. So sexual problems, we think in this that 35% is either a problem or a disorder. People don't usually make that distinction when they're filling out surveys. But if they answer to that, you know, percentage in that survey, that's a third of the population has either a worry. It's not just a worry; they have a problem or a disorder when it relates to sexuality. This is a big sexual health issue. And the two most common populations that have report sexual problems are younger women and older men. Online sexual behavior worries and problems. We've talked a little bit about what the worries are. These are the common worries that everybody has. What's my partner doing online? Do they go online to sex sites? Have they ever done that? Where do they go? What do they do? Why would they do that? Somebody who might be going online to a sexual site might be wondering at home, well, what if the history of the sites I go to gets discovered on my computer? What if I don't want somebody to know which sex site I go to. There's all sorts of, you know, worries about that sort of personal privacy of one's life, their fantasy, erotic interest being discovered or disclosed when they didn't want it to be. And of course, a significant worry is it okay to masturbate if I'm online? You know, we don't have, you know, is that okay? Is that a reasonable thing to do? We don't know. People have a variety of opinions about that. When we get into the problem areas, these are some of the most common factors that really let you know you have some online problems. more than just worries. Secrets and dishonesty are such an important part of this. When somebody begins to be highly invested in their online sexual behavior having to be a secret, and will cover up and be dishonest about what they're doing online, and be repetitively dishonest about what they're doing online, that can become a significant problem. Time spent online. I'm going to show you some research that's been done. Well, this is one of the areas that's been most heavily researched about online sexual behavior, and that is the amount of time spent online that they've actually been able to measure and get a sense of how much time you spend online is highly correlated with how significant of a problem you may have with online sexual behavior. So time spent is important. I treat men who are concerned about online sexual behavior, and by far the most common complaint men have who come to me and say, I want to change, I don't like, I want to stop what I'm doing online, is they're just spending so much time online. You know, they're 35 years old, and they're looking at their life, and they think, is this what I wanted for my life at 35 years old? I'm spending 20 hours a week online in front of a computer for sex, or more. And it gets to be kind of this kind of really personal question of quality of life. Is this really what I want for my life? And the reason they're coming for help is because they decided they don't want to be doing this, and they can't stop. Money can be a very significant factor for online sexual behavior. Paying money for sex sites, you can use a credit card for all sorts of things online for sexual activity, and people will hide credit card transactions in their relationship. They'll go get a separate credit card their spouse doesn't know about so that they can charge things online and have that credit card sent to a P.O. box, and they can have a whole line of money going on that the partner doesn't even know about in order to support their online sexual activity. So money's a big factor around dishonesty, secrecy, and just costs. You know, this is money coming out of the household that isn't budgeted, and the couple hasn't agreed, okay, well, you get $100 a month for your online sexual activity, no more. Don't go over budget. These aren't the kind of conversations people are having in their houses. So money becomes a huge issue. Just even the fact that people feel very ambivalent about the fact that they are spending money for sexual activity online. And they may have their own mixed feelings about that and may not like it. So that can be a big problem. This is another huge factor in problems with online sexual behavior, and that is people have commitments and fail to meet those commitments because of their online sexual activity. It could just be commitments to supervising and watching the children. You know, somebody could be, the wife is away, or the partner is away, and the other partner is responsible for childcare, and all they're doing is planning all day how the kids can be taken care of by somebody else in the neighborhood so they can be online for a couple hours while the spouse is away. And then, of course, one of the kids come home, they got injured unexpectedly, and come home and find dad in a place that they didn't expect to find dad. These are real events that happen in homes. That the online activity will become so important, people begin to set aside other interests, other concerns, other priorities, other relationships to make sure they have time for that online experience. When it becomes that important, that's a problem. When is online sexual behavior actually something that might be out of control? You can have a problem, and then something can actually go to that threshold of kind of being out of control. This is the hardest one of all. This usually requires, I think, a lot of good evaluation and assessment. You don't want to jump to this conclusion very readily. Oftentimes, even a discussion about sexual behavior being out of control, the most common label given it immediately in a discussion is that you're a sex addict. Oftentimes, even if there's even some problems with online sexual behavior, most people, the conversation begins with, I think you're a sex addict, where it is as if it's like a label or a diagnosis or a conclusion that's immediately made because we're just having a dialogue about what could be a problem or could really be something that's seriously out of control. And oftentimes this conclusion is jumped to quite often. So somebody will walk into my office And they're there to meet with me because they're concerned about their online sexual behavior. And they'll sit down and they'll say, I'm a sex addict. And oftentimes what I find myself saying to them is, well, who told you that? How long have you thought that about yourself? You're here to figure out if that is the case. If you walked into a doctor's office and just announced, I have cancer, and the doctor went, oh, well, that saved us a lot of time. Thank you. We would think that's preposterous. But when it comes to sexual concerns, particularly when sex is out of control, it's so difficult to have the conversation about it, and it's so difficult to find somebody who's really informed enough to have the conversation with you, that oftentimes we'll jump to the diagnosis quickly just so we can kind of get on with it and not have to talk about it. And so you really have to watch out for this premature, I call it premature evaluation, this movement too quickly to wanting to call any concerns around sexual behavior out of control, sex addiction, a diseased state that needs treatment. I mean, when somebody's concerned about drug addiction or alcoholism or gambling or other kinds of out of control behaviors, we tend to want to look at it a little more closely before we make a confirmation or a conclusion about that condition. Same needs to be true with sexual behavior. So these are some of the things that are the most common factors when looking at when sex really becomes out of control. And this has been pretty well researched. We find this fairly consistent in a lot of measures in a lot of populations around the country. First of all, is that there's a recurrent failure to control their online sexual behavior. Now, I'll see this in my office where somebody will come in and they'll have made a really bad choice online. They were experimenting with something, and they ended up for the first time deciding to meet somebody sexually for a one-time encounter, and they go to this place and they get robbed. Terrible thing that happened. And they'll come to my office saying, I think I'm a sex addict. And we'll go over their whole online history, and they've never had any kind of problems other than this one really, really poor choice and poor decision. And we'd have to figure out what were the circumstances around that as to why that happened. One of the most common situations around poor decision-making online is being under the influence of drugs and alcohol. It's one of the first things you got to check out. How often have you been drinking, using drugs, while you're going online? There's a whole subpopulation of people who have sexual problems, this is among men who have sex with men or gay men. It's very highly correlated now with being online, finding sexual partners who are either going to have crystal meth or use crystal meth with you, or you're already under the influence of crystal meth and seeking sex partners while you're under the influence of crystal meth. And the most common way crystal meth addicts who want to have sex with other crystal meth addicts find each other is online, by far. They find each other, and they can go. There's all these sites where crystal addicts can find each other, find out who they want to have sex with, and go and have sex with them. And they'll have multiple sex partners over a period of days being under the influence of crystal. So that some drugs and alcohol have very high sex drug linked behavior. So oftentimes these failures to control online sexual behavior is highly correlated with being under the influence of drugs and alcohol. That's the number one factor why people have a hard time with controlling it. So many times you may have an untreated alcoholism or drug addiction that needs to be looked at first before we even see if there really is a problem with online behavior. Maybe the online behavior was only related to the drug and alcohol use, and as soon as that's treated, the recurrent failure of online behavior control just goes away because it was so drug-related. But sometimes people get clean and sober, and they discover that they are still involved in the out-of-control online sexual behavior, even though they're not using drugs or alcohol anymore with that behavior. Continuing the online sexual behavior despite repeated, and the important thing there is repeated, negative consequences. You know, a classic symptom of something being out of control is that you keep doing it despite the negative consequences. I can't help myself. I just keep doing it. And oftentimes people will come in for help with online behavior, and they'll say, I tried putting my modem in a closet locked at night. I tried, putting my computer in my car trunk. They tried all these things to try to stop the behavior. And they couldn't stop it. I told myself I wasn't going to do it. I stopped for 3 weeks and I started again. Whatever it is, but they'll have negative consequences. You know, see the light. That's it. I'm going to stop, and then they keep doing it. So that's a very common thing of something being out of control. Hours per week. We actually know through research, when we ask people how much time you spend online in sexual activity, and then we give them measures at the same time that measure whether somebody may actually have out-of-control sexual behavior. It's a fairly consistent figure. If somebody's spending 11, believe it or not, 11, 11 or more hours a week online in the pursuit of sexual activity, the minute they go above that threshold, they're higher risk for having out-of-control sexual behavior. So if somebody's spending 20 hours or 25 hours a week online in the pursuit of sexual activity, those are somebody that are very high risk of possibly having out-of-control sexual behavior. If somebody's online for 3 hours a week in the pursuit of sexual activity, they still could have out-of-control sexual behavior. It depends on what they're doing for those 3 hours and how negative the consequences are. But we know from a time-spent measure, 11 or more hours a week is a good indicator that you should look at this. There could be a problem, and it could, you know, at least there could be a problem. I don't know if it's out of control. And the time of day engaged in online sexual behavior. The number of people who come into my office, and they'll be up till 2, 3 in the morning online. Their, you know, spouse is in bed, or, you know, or they live alone, and they've got the laptop in their bed with them, or whatever. And they get lost in time, and they're online for hours and hours and hours. And then they fall asleep, and they have to get up, and they have to go to work. They're not functioning at work as well. They're tired. Or another time of day is doing it during work. People might work at home. People might be going to the office. You know, that's a time of day when you're not supposed to be online for sexual activity, but you might be actually doing it at work. You might be doing it when you've made a commitment to do something else. I don't know if any of you have ever been on the phone with somebody when you're talking to them and you hear that telltale click, 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 click in the background, and you know you don't have their complete attention because they're talking to you and they're also typing away on a keyboard. Now, somebody you could be talking to could be typing away on a keyboard and they could be looking at sexual images. You don't know. So, you know, there's all sorts of things that affect what am I supposed to be doing this time of the day? And I'm not doing it because I'm looking at sexual images instead. Those are all things that are very classic signs of sexual behavior being out of control. Some of the consequences that most often lead to somebody wanting to seek help for out of control sexual behavior. First and foremost, if there's a primary relationship, if there's a meaningful relationship in their life or several meaningful relationships in their lives with their employer, with their spouse, with their children, with their family, you know, if those are important relationships to them and the online activity is affecting those relationships, oftentimes they walk, or with their church or their faith, very important relationships, with their creed, if they feel like they're in violation of that relationship as well, oftentimes people will seek out help for online behavior because a certain relationship is threatened or is really in trouble because of the online activity. Or possibly they've lost a relationship or several relationships because of the online activity. So interfering with relationships is very significant. You know, marriages and significant turmoil, fighting all the time, secrecy and mistrust because of the online activity. That they may be having a lot of life problems, and those life problems are directly linked with their out-of-control sexual behavior. Somebody might be really depressed. They've never been treated for depression. And, you know, they're somewhat sort of treating some of the symptoms of their depression by pursuing online sexual activity and having sexual arousal kind of get them a little bit out of a depressed mood for just a little bit of period of time. Or somebody might be really anxious and nervous all the time, very scared and, you know, always tense. And we know orgasms relax the body. So they might be seeking out, you know, orgasms at a fairly high interval just to kind of relax their body so they can feel not so anxious. Those are untreated, you know, psychiatric or medical conditions that, you know, that's a life problem. And that could be linked to why they're involved in out-of-control sexual behavior. Not meeting commitments. This is a really big one. I've had people in my office who talk about, I have to give this up. I can't imagine my children ever knowing this about me. They're committed to wanting to be a good parent and be a parent that they want, that children can feel they are proud of and feel good about, and their online behavior may be threatening that discovery or something like that, that would really threaten their ability to be a good parent. They have commitments to their marriage or their relationship, certain sexual agreements or relationship or trust, and they're not meeting those commitments because of their out-of-control sexual behavior, and they want to meet those commitments, and they're really torn by that. So these are common motivations why people seek help, because their people are concerned about these things. And these are very common kind of symptoms that people will talk about. The intensity of the sexual arousal online will feel out of control to people, in the sense that it becomes the preferred form of arousal or interest sexually for them. Partnered sex, relational sex becomes less interesting, less meaningful, might even be not even pleasurable for them. And they're very concerned about that somehow this online experience is becoming more than I ever thought it would be. And they're very concerned about that. Some people might be concerned that being online involved in any kind of sexual activity is actually somehow reprogramming their sexual arousal system. And it might, they're concerned about it sort of changing it or altering it in a way that they can't go back once it's been altered in that way. So, people get very concerned sometimes about just their arousal and the intensity of their arousal response to certain online issues. Some people may discover same-sex attractions through online activity and be just completely terrified by the fact that they're discovering an arousal to a same-sex encounter. They never thought they could ever feel that, and it scares them a lot. People can find out about something about themselves by being online and be very frightened about that. Of course, online behavior at work is a very significant factor. If people are doing this at work, many times they'll come for treatment because they're very concerned they're doing this at work. So these are three key questions that we're going to finish with. These are the key questions that if you're concerned about online sexual behavior, if you're wondering if you have an online sexual behavior problem, or if you're even thinking, gee, maybe my online behavior might actually be out of control, these are three questions to think about. Just think about them. One is, where am I going online? What are these sites? What am I doing? What are the activities? What am I doing? What am I actually doing when I go online? How do I feel about that? What are the pictures I'm looking at? How do I feel about that? What are the actual images I seek? How do I feel and think about? What's the meaning of these images I'm seeking out? Are they of concern to me? Or are they actually just kind of something I enjoy? What kind of people am I talking with online? Who are these people? Why am I drawn to them? What's so important about those people that I want to talk to online? What are my reasons for being online? These two are the most commonly associated with out-of-control sexual behavior. That either the person is using online sexual behavior as a significant or primary stress coping mechanism. They're using it to not feel. They're using it to get away from life. They're using it to kind of just disconnect from the world. They're using it to escape. Whatever the stress is in life, they're using that online activity to just completely escape from all that. That's a stress coping mechanism. That's highly correlated with sexual behavior becoming out of control. Also, they're engaging in sexual activity online they would never, ever consider doing with their partner, with somebody they're attracted to or interested in, or even experimenting with themselves. That the online world becomes this unique place where that's the only place that sexual expression would ever be considered. That kind of separation, where the online sexual world is this, and the rest of my sexual world is over here, and they don't connect. That's a breeding ground for things to get out of control. When anything in our life is so separate, so not integrated into who we are, something like that can not have good decision making about it, and things can get out of control. And again, here's time. the 11 hours a week. You can really, if people come into my office and they're concerned about their online activity and they don't really have a good sense of how much time they're online, I may ask them to actually chart it. You know, write down every 15 minutes you're online doing sexual activity and we'll count them up. So many hours you're spending online. It's amazing how people will underestimate how much time they spend online. They don't overestimate. They underestimate how many hours they're online. So actually keeping a diary or a log of how much time you spend online can be quite eye-opening to people. I never imagined I was spending that much time online. And the other thing is that people with out-of-control online sexual behavior often report they'll sit down at the computer and they'll commit to a certain amount of time they were going to be there. And over and over and over and over again, they spend way much more time online than they ever planned. They're just, I'm going to only be on here for an hour. 5 hours later, they're getting offline. That's one of the most common patterns of behavior you'll see with people with out-of-control online sexual behavior. So these are three sites I want to give you information about. These are some really, really terrific sexual health information sites that I really encourage you to check out. CECUS is the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States. CECUS is the center of sexual health information, services, education, very comprehensive for all ages, all cultures, all communities within the United States. CECUS is the central site for really good sexual health information. And their website is a terrific place for that. Sex Ed Library, just as a new resource, it just started within the last year. And sexedlibrary.org is really a resource for educators, therapists, healthcare providers, anybody who teaches or is concerned about educating about sexual health. Whether it be a patient in a medical office, a dentist, a nurse, a chiropractor, whomever. Sex Ed Library is a great resource for sexual health-related education materials and information. The last site, sexology.cjb.net, this is what I believe is the best sexual health education site in the world. The site location is in Germany, but actually the site itself, I think, is in four or five different languages. English is one of the languages that the site is in. You just go to the site, they have different flags that are associated with that language. Click on that flag, and the whole site turns into that language. You can, I think, French and I think Japanese. I'm not sure what all the languages are, but it's quite a spectrum of different languages. So it's a good one for particularly Spanish-speaking clients who English isn't a first language, and oftentimes for sexual health information, a lot of times people don't know as much sexual health information in their second language as they do their first. Although I teach human sexuality at San Diego State, and I had this interesting experience with a student last week or this semester, who did not know the word, I can't remember what the sex act was, but she didn't know the word for that sex act in Spanish, but she knew it in English, and Spanish was her first language. And so that was sort of an interesting experience for her and where she came from, that in the culture and language she came from, she didn't even know the word for that particular sexual activity, but she knew it in English. So language is a very important aspect around sexual health. So that's what I like about that site, is people can learn about sexual health information in their first language, if possible, which is very helpful. So those are some sites I really highly recommend. And from those sites, you can find almost every sexual health information site on the web. CECUS in particular. These are very completely legitimate, very valid resources for sexual information. They are not going to connect you with places that you don't want to go when you put SEX on the internet under Google. So that's why I also listed them. These are responsible and very useful sites you can go to. And lastly, what do you do if you think your sexual behavior is out of control? I always give online resources because that's where people are. You might as well start where you are. So go online. Before you go to bed one night, and check these out. One is the Society for the Advancement of Sexual Health, or SASH.net, which is a resource that gives a lot of information about treatment resources around the country that are available for people with out-of-control sexual behavior, therapists within your community all over the country who are members of the organization. You can find out. So if you're somewhere else in the United States watching this, you know, go to SASH, and you might find somebody more locally in your community who would be available to... maybe talk to. I want to give the Satcher Coalition call to action site. I think reading the consensus report on sexual health is a really interesting experience because it really validates how far we have to go in our country to reach much consensus on anything to do with sexual health. What I think is most important to read about that report is what they could not agree on. You would be astonished and shocked to see what basic aspects of sexuality these people from the cross spectrum of the United States could not agree on. That we have enormous disagreement around sexual health in our country. And we need to be conscious of that. Not a judgment, it's just reality. And then lastly, if you're here in San Diego, this is my website, sexualdependency.com, and I do provide assessments and information for people who are interested in possibly, you know, a concern about someone's sexual behavior. I only work with men, and I work with men of all sexual orientations. So that's a resource locally if you happen to be watching this in the San Diego area. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you very much for attending today. And for those of you who are going to be picking this up online, I know that you will find it very informative. Thank you very much, Doug, for coming. It was a pleasure to have you. And thank you for your generosity of time and your world of knowledge.